In technology, it's really about making the right big bets. And, you know, it takes really many years before you actually see whether the bets that you've made return on investment. But you have to make those choices. I mean, certainly we've been working on AI, you know, for the better part of the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. And before there was a ChatGPT, there was, you know, the idea that you need different types of processing.
Welcome to Ask More of AI, the podcast looking at the intersection of AI and business. I'm Clara Shai, CEO of Salesforce AI, and I'm thrilled to be here today with the chair and CEO of AMD, Lisa Su. Lisa, you are one of the Fortune 500 CEOs I admire the most. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me, Clara. It's great to be here.
You know, what an exciting time to be in the AI world. And so much of the world's fascination is around the chips, because it's really a shift from the CPUs of yesterday to the GPUs and the virtualization layers and the optimization of today. Could we just start by, you know, talking about what is a day in the life of Lisa Su like?
Sure. Well, first of all, Clara, you know, I've been in the semiconductor chip industry for the last 30 years, and it used to be nobody knew what a chip was. They were like, what? What's a semiconductor? What does that have to do with anything? And I think it's pretty amazing, you know, just how much technology has kind of changed the way, you know, we live and we work and, you know, we do business. And that's kind of how I became interested in this field. So a day in the life is, it can be anything. It can be, you know, what is our next product that we're going to do over the next like 3 to 5 years, to, you know, spending time, a lot of time with customers and other folks, you know, partners, and, you know, spending time with people like yourself who are, you know, changing the world in AI. So,
well, thank you for your kind words. I mean, just the amount of domains that you and your team have to be experts in. I'm thinking material science, electrical engineering, manufacturing, increasingly software, the large language models themselves, all the pieces. I mean, how do you keep up with all of this?
Well, you're right in that, you know, technology has become much, much more multidisciplinary than it, you know, was in the past. Now, you know, for us, it really is about, you know, trying to predict a little bit into the future. So, you know, with, you know, silicon and hardware, the design cycle times are so long, and you know, just you have to do a new architecture. It really is like, you know, 3 to 5 years, which means we have to decide early in advance. So, you know, way before there was a ChatGPT and people were thinking about generative AI, you know, we were thinking about, hey, how do you build the largest supercomputers in the world? Like, what kind of technology do you need to do that? And that requires hardware and software and, you know, systems knowledge and working closely with, you know, large users of the technology and the people who are writing the applications. And so, yes, we do have to integrate all of those things. But, you know, there are some fundamental principles, which is, you know, everybody needs more high performance computing. And that's a good foundational element for all of the AI, you know, advances we're talking about today.
How do you even find people who have expertise in all of those different disciplines?
Well, one of the things that I find most interesting about the technology world, and I'm, you know, really, you know, curious, you know, what you've seen, I think, is the idea that we're always learning. So it's not, you know, you don't go to school and say, hey, I'm going to design, you know, the next high performance GPU that's going to, you know, train, you know, the next large language model. Like, that's not what we do. What we really do is we try to find people who are really thinking about, you know, all of these disciplines, whether it's the newest architecture, you know, what do we do with the technology. You know, one of the things that's really important for us is deciding what technologies to use, you know, what packaging technologies to use, you know, how we integrate all of that. And so you want people who are experts in all of these disciplines, but then can also see across. So you want, you know, vertical expertise as well as horizontal expertise, you know, to make that all happen. But a lot of it comes down to, you know, just, you know, on the job training and learning. And I can say, you know, even though I've been in the industry a long, long time, like, I've never learned more than in the last like couple of years with just how fast the entire AI industry is moving.
It's really incredible. You have a fascinating story. You started out in electrical engineering. You got your PhD. How did you, did you anticipate becoming the CEO of AMD someday?
I can say definitely not. Definitely not. I did start off as an electrical engineer, you know, went to school for, you know, sort of semiconductor devices. I think the way I got into semiconductors is, and I know there are lots of stories like this, but it was, you know, freshman year, I needed a job. And, you know, frankly, you look for a job. And I took a job in a semiconductor lab helping a grad student, you know, do their research things. And I kind of fell in love with this idea that you could build these, you know, amazing chips with, you know, with all of this device technology. And over time, you realize that, you know, like what I love most about technology is seeing products in action. So, you know, being able to walk down to Best Buy and see, you know, one of our latest generation AI PCs is kind of a fun task. Or, you know, walking into these large data centers where you see, you know, some of the gear that, you know, we put for, you know, the largest supercomputer in the world, which is, you know, currently sitting at Oak Ridge National Labs. Like, that's, you know, a lot of fun. So that's kind of the notion of, you know, bringing together, why do you go to school for all these things? It's so that you can build, you know, great products that that people can use to, you know, discover, you know, the next big, you know, research, medical, all kinds of discoveries, you know, in the world.
Was there a point during your tenure as in a more technical role that you realized that you wanted to focus more on the management or business side?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I started out in research and development, as you can imagine, as a you know, as a young, you know, PhD, you know, person. And I realized that in technology fields, it's really important to have some, you know, sort of intuitive feeling about what's going on in the technology. And so I felt like, hey, you know, I love building the product, but it's really important that you make the right strategy decisions and that you're going after the right markets. And it's important to have some technology background there. So that was the main reason. I mean, it's this idea that, you know, it's kind of fun to be able to decide direction. And, you know, to do that required more management and business, you know, expertise.
And I think that's increasingly going to be the case, right? As so much of strategy will be shaped and defined even by the technology itself.
I think so. I mean, certainly in the fields that we're in, right? To decide, you know, when we do any new product or, you know, any new project, I mean, they're at least, you know, triple-digit million-dollar investments, you know, maybe, you know, billions of dollars of investment. You got to be pretty sure you're going in the right direction because they're just, you know, such monumental decisions. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've actually designed a device, so or designed a chip. But you know, spending time with the you know, the engineering team and, you know, the architects on saying, hey, this is what our roadmap should look like going forward, is, you know, some of the most you know, fun stuff that I get to do.
That's right. And now you're designing an organization and an investment allocation to enable the designing of the chips and the virtualization layer and the whole system.
That's right. I think the whole point is, in technology, it's really about making the right big bets. And, you know, it takes really many years before you actually see whether the bets that you've made return on investment, but you have to make those choices. I mean, certainly we've been working on AI, you know, for the better part of the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. And, before there was a ChatGPT, there was, you know, the idea that you need different types of processing. You need, you know, sort of CPUs are more general purpose processing, and they're used for more traditional and legacy applications. Whereas, you know, GPUs are the new parallel processing where you can do, you know, lots of operations in parallel and, you know, perfect for AI. And now there's so much innovation on top of that in terms of data formats and new models and all of that stuff. You know, all of these are just things that require long-term investment.
So let's rewind the clock to 7 years ago. What was that aha moment that made you realize that the company needed to invest in GPUs in addition to CPUs?
Yeah, the main point, and I would even generalize it further, Clara, the main point, you know, in my belief is that for computing, there's no one size fits all. So when you think about all of the different, you know, workloads that, you know, come about, whether you're talking about, you know, traditional computing, or you're talking about high performance simulations and computing, or you're talking about AI computing, or you're talking about what you use in your PC or your phone. You need different types of computing engines. And that was the main thing that we wanted to do at AMD, which is to expand beyond, you know, sort of, you know, traditional computing. And so, you know, we've made a bunch of acquisitions. We've invested heavily on the GPU side. And I think we have, I would say, arguably one of the most complete portfolios of, you know, end-to-end computing capabilities. So whether you're talking about in the, you know, the biggest iron in the cloud infrastructure, or you're talking about, you know, at the edge in applications, or you're talking about, you know, personal computing, I think you're going to need the right type of compute. And that's something that I've always believed in.
So NVIDIA is probably the best known as being out of, you know, the first out of the gate for GPUs. And how are you thinking about how you compete with them or coexist with NVIDIA?
Well, you know, again, if I take a step back and look at what's happening in the market, the market is a really you know, broad market in terms of so many different applications, you know, so many different types of compute that are necessary. Like when we look at the growth in just data center infrastructure, we would say, you know, this is a $400 billion plus market, you know, by 2027. So it's tremendous growth. And underneath that, like, again, there's no one size fits all. You need different types of compute. I think that we have a very, very strong portfolio. I think the idea that sometimes you need CPUs, sometimes you need GPUs, sometimes you need, you know, ASICs and combinations of these, that is what we are, you know, really doing from a strategy standpoint. And it's about having the right compute for the right application.
And what types of applications do you think that AMD will excel in?
Well, for sure, we've done a lot of work in, you know, sort of the cloud and, you know, the largest hyperscalers, and working with, you know, the folks, you know, like Salesforce, like others who are, you know, really, you know, pushing the envelope on what you do in the cloud. And, you know, in the cloud, it's all about how efficient is your compute. It's not just about performance. It's about performance per watt in terms of power efficiency. It's about performance per dollar in terms of total cost of ownership. We have, you know, we work with every large major hyperscaler, and I'm, you know, very thankful for the deep partnerships that we have there. And we co-innovate. We actually, you know, with each generation, we get even more optimized to what the needs of, you know, the large cloud hyperscalers need. And that's true on the CPU side, on the GPU side, as well as, you know, on the, you know, overall, you know, solutions that are necessary. And then we're also very interested in, you know, working with large enterprises, because, you know, enterprises also have, you know, very unique applications as well in terms of what they need for next generation computing.
I find it fascinating. A lot of people focus on the GPU, but really it's racks of GPUs and racks of CPUs and how it all comes together. And kind of on that point, I was curious, congratulations, by the way, on your acquisition of ZT Systems, if you could talk more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we see is a world where the computing that you need for AI is just becoming much more all-encompassing. So it's not, you know, the components are important, and, you know, our architects work night and day to make sure that you can have the most optimized CPU and the most optimized GPU. But it's also how we put them together in systems, because, as you know, Clara, you know, these new models are like, you know, hundreds of billions of parameters, or even, you know, a trillion parameters. And when you have models at large, you actually need these systems really clustered in, you know, tens of thousands of GPUs or hundreds of thousands of GPUs. And so solutions become, you know, really important. So, yeah, we're very excited. We just announced our acquisition of ZT Systems, and it is really kind of the third leg in the stool. So if you think about, you know, silicon investment, really important. We've made a lot of investments in a roadmap there, you know, software investments. We've also made significant software acquisitions. And then with now ZT Systems, we get the solutions and kind of wraps it all together.
You've made a significant number of these acquisitions. How do you integrate them into the organization?
Well, it is really important that, you know, we're clear on how we integrate. So, you know, if I think about the history of AMD, I've been CEO now almost 10 years, which seems like a long time.
Amazing.
But it still doesn't seem like, seems like I still have a lot to do. But we start with the notion of it is about organic investments as well. So if you think about our roadmap, we've made substantial organic investments. And then we look for you know, M&A to help, you know, really round out parts of the portfolio. So, you know, our, you know, first large acquisition was the acquisition of Xilinx, which, you know, still stands as, I think, the largest semiconductor, you know, acquisition. And it actually brought just tremendous talent into the company. So we brought, you know, 5,000 people into the company that were really experts on embedded computing. And, you know, that was really, really helpful. We've made a number of software acquisitions, and you know, software acquisitions very well. It's just a wonderful way of bringing in, you know, really expert people very quickly. Integration is all about ensuring that they know exactly where they fit into the overall picture. And now, you know, we're excited to really announce the acquisition of a systems company with ZT Systems.
That's really exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You mentioned, you know, that AMD 7 years ago was already thinking about emerging trends and really being able to see around corners and make predictions about the future. And you saw then the importance of providing different types of chips and systems for different types of workloads. What do you see now? I mean, from the vantage point of 2024, what are you preparing for next that you can talk about?
Yeah, so it is a really exciting time, Claire, when I think about, you know, what we're seeing going forward over the next 5+ years. We really do see, and I think you and I probably share this this feeling, like AI is the megatrend of all megatrends, right? It is the technology that, you know, kind of... you know, if you look forward and say what you can do with AI that is so different than what you've done with traditional computing systems, I think that's what's really exciting for me. And how that comes about is, you know, we see AI in every product that we build. And, you know, that is from the biggest data center infrastructure, you know, CPUs, GPUs, networking, to everything, you know, the whole gamut to, you know, what we put in embedded devices to what we put in, you know, PCs. And the whole idea is you need the right compute for each area. You know, seeing around the corner, we would love, you know, AI to accelerate everything we do in the world. Like, we can really see that whether you're talking about enterprise productivity, you're talking about personal productivity, you're talking about research productivity, you're talking about, you know, how do we deliver medicine? All of these areas are areas where, you know, AI can substantially change the way we experience these things. And at the underpinnings of all that is having the right tech for that.
So I'd love to talk about each of those areas where the GPUs need to be used. You mentioned earlier the AI PC. What, for people who don't know, what is that? And how is that different than a traditional PC?
Yeah, sure. So AI PCs are relatively new. You know, let's call it, this is the first year of the AI PCs. And it's the idea that, you know, today, you know, your PCs have a lot of productivity capability. But when you're running these large language models, or when you're, you know, using something like ChatGPT, you're actually going into the cloud. Like, you don't have enough processing power on your PC. That means you always have to be connected if you're asking a question. Sometimes when you ask a question, you know, there may be some latency, so you have to wait, like, you know, a couple seconds because, you know, you're going somewhere else and you're using sort of a general computing resource. Whereas if you have an AI PC, now we're putting sort of that AI capability directly in your laptop.
So the laptop has GPUs.
It has GPUs. It also has something that we call an NPU, or for us, we call it Ryzen AI. And it's a local computing capability, so that, you know, in the future, when you're asking, you know, ChatGPT something, instead of going into the cloud, you actually can do it on your local environment. And there's a lot of advantages to that, you know, besides the fact that it is your local computing. So, you know, privacy concerns are one of those areas where you don't necessarily want everything that you do going into the cloud. And there are opportunities to be, you know, much faster and, you know, really much more personalized.
Yeah, and our research group recently released several small and medium language models, and those are meant to run offline on a device. We'll have to try your AI PC. We have a number of Salesforce customers, for example, that are field service technicians. They're out sometimes driving in rural areas. They're not always connected to the internet. So it's a perfect use case.
The Salesforce applications that you just mentioned are perfect examples of why AI PCs are super valuable, because you know the idea is you have so many different cases where sometimes you might be operating on these mega databases where you absolutely have to be connected to the cloud, but other times you're operating on just what are you doing with this customer. And it'd be really nice to be able to do it, at your client space. And that's the idea of the right compute for the right use case.
It's also interesting to think about, we're probably not too far away from every consumer also having their own AI agent or assistant, and how that might make sense to run locally also.
You're completely right. I think that's another area where we're just really in the infancy. Like this idea of all of us can use a personal assistant, and I know I can. And, with AI PCs, you're going to have much more capability locally. And again, privacy.
So that's the AI PC. You also mentioned embedded devices. What's that?
Yeah. So embedded devices are devices that go into things like automotive, industrial, sort of telecommunications, aerospace and defense, those types of applications. And there you can use AI as well. And that type of AI is much more real-time data processing. So you can imagine, if you're in an industrial application, there's a whole bunch of data that you're gathering with sensors, and you'd like to be able to process that in real time. And that's also a very great use case for AI. Again, not in the large cloud environments where you can, have things that are like, thousands and thousands of watts or megawatts, but really in something that is embedded in the field.
Yeah, much more efficient, much faster.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then do you see these different AI sources, from the PC to these embedded devices for industrials to the cloud, the interplay? Are you thinking about how those work together?
It's a great point. The answer is absolutely yes. And perhaps the most important thing of how they work together is ensuring that you can share data amongst those environments, and also ensure that the software environment is such that developers don't have to learn a new language every time they move from a different device. Things like, for example, Stable Diffusion, which is one of those models that people use when you're talking about text to image. Like, you can run Stable Diffusion on a PC. You can also run it in the cloud. You really want to have sort of a very common environment so that people don't have to relearn it.
And how are you doing that? Have you released a standard or products?
Yeah, we're very much believers, Clara, in the open source ecosystem. So, that's kind of the mantra of AMD when we think about how software should be developed. What do people really want? They really want their software to kind of be abstracted from the hardware layer. Like, software developers shouldn't need to care so much as to what's underneath. You should have, good libraries and good tools and good frameworks to kind of abstract that. So we work a lot in the open source. We have something called our Rockham software suite, and it works, very much, with things like, PyTorch and TensorFlow and Onyx and these other, higher level, frameworks.
Could you share some specific use cases about how you use AI internally for your operations at AMD?
Yes. So I think all of us as CEOs, like, I can't go to an event where, I'm sitting with other CEOs where we're not comparing notes about, are we going fast enough? What are you guys doing to use AI internally? For us, we're running hundreds of pilots throughout the company. They start, probably the most strategic use of AI for us is in designing chips. So, for us, our chips are super complicated. Like, our largest GPUs today are 150 billion plus transistors. That's our MI300. And you need every transistor to be right, frankly. You can't have one not be right. And so we are using AI to help us in the design process, help us, you know, as we design libraries, help us as we write software, help us as we write test validation suites, how we bring up yields, how we, you know, look at different trade-offs for more optimized chips.
How have you brought along the company in terms of how everyone does their job every day to embrace AI and how to upskill and continuously reskill as the technologies evolve?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think this is back to, you know, the company has to be a learning company. Like, we have a culture of always wanting to continue to learn and ensure that, you know, with each generation, you know, we're more efficient and more capable, especially as it relates to AI. These pilots are very much bottoms up as much as they are tops down. So, you know, we have, you know, really embraced the idea that engineers want to learn more. And so as we've done these pilots, we've had, you know, they're really engineering led in terms of, you know, which tools that we bring on. How do we decide which ones go into production? You know, those types of things. And I think going forward, the key piece is that, you know, we continue to really, there's not a one size fits all in terms of how to bring AI into the company. It really is very much depending on the individual functions and ensuring that each function gets access to the tools.
It's really an empowerment that you are providing from the top, and then individuals, whether they're engineers or first line managers, and then those functional leaders can really adapt it and adopt it organically.
That's right. I think it's the infrastructure has to be, you know, getting the leading edge tools out there, and then ensuring that the you know, all of the management team really understand how this can help them, you know, become more productive.
Which is, you know, much easier said than done. I think a lot of organizations that may not have had to do that in the past are trying to do that now. And so what advice would you have for those CEOs?
I think the main thing is it does need a tops-down umbrella, in the sense that, you know, people are so busy on an everyday basis. To have them actually change their workflow actually requires, sometimes you have to go slower to go faster. And I think that's the key thing is, you know, ensuring that, you know, this isn't just about bringing in new tools. You actually have to change your workflow. And so the conversation around, hey, this is a strategic imperative, and we believe, you know, set a number, like over the next, you know, X number of years, you know, you can get, you know, 25% benefit or some big number, really helps motivate the organization to, you know, do the work on the, you know, sort of the individual, you know, pilot by pilot basis.
Can you share an example of one of these bottoms up pilots that's been particularly successful and what you learned in the process?
Probably one of the earliest pilots that, you know, we've done is, you know, using, you know, GitHub for, you know, some of the, you know, software capabilities. It was really beneficial. I mean, what we saw was, you know, software developers had to decide, you know, first there was a little bit of trepidation on, you know, can we trust the, you know, the co-pilot work. But then what we found is it actually helped free up engineering time, because some of the newer developers, you know, would often need to go to some more senior developers to get help. You know, now we were able to, you know, kind of really streamline, you know, some of that in the process. You know, I'm very passionate about is even, you know, skills development around semiconductors and ensuring that there is the right amount of, you know, university, you know, both capability, because you actually need a lot of infrastructure to make that happen. And as it relates to AI, it's the same thing, right? So to teach people AI in universities, you actually need access to compute. And much of what we do is actually help some of these universities get access to compute. There's also a lot of learning on the job, and, you know, through internships and through you know, continuing education. You know, these are, you know, some ways that we get the sort of everyone, you know, sort of reskilled to the new needs.
It's fascinating. It needs to happen at every level. I was just meeting with the superintendent of the school district that my kids are in, and they're thinking about, okay, what does this mean? Should we ban AI? Should we teach it? Everyone is asking these questions.
Hopefully people aren't banning AI, but it's the right usage is the important thing. I'm a big believer in The answer is, how do we use AI for good and not, yes, there are some things that we have to be careful about, but the overall power of the technology is such that there's a huge opportunity.
That's right. I mean, can you imagine in the 90s if someone had said, we're going to ban any type of internet usage, right? And just how far that would actually set back the kids in that school system.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. We have an election coming up. And given the geopolitical landscape, how are you thinking about navigating through having a resilient supply chain and other considerations?
Well, I think what we have certainly realized through the pandemic and then through some of the geopolitical situation that, semiconductors are a critical, capability. I think they're key for national security in some cases, but certainly for overall, the global economy. And so with that, with anything in that realm, the geographic diversity is very, very important. And from that standpoint, we're really pleased with the CHIPS Act. I think the CHIPS Act is a pretty monumental thing for the semiconductor industry in terms of just how much investment is going into trying to ensure that there's good resiliency. We're very actively working on moving some of our manufacturing to some of the U.S. Capabilities here. Our manufacturing partner is TSMC. They're building in Arizona. We're never going to get, we shouldn't expect that we're ever going to get, all manufacturing in the United States. But getting some of it and having geographic diversity, I think those are very positive things.
Which is probably something that every industry should probably look at.
Exactly.
Yeah. That makes sense. What advice would you have for young people, going in college right now or entering the workforce? I mean, the world is about to change so rapidly. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah. So, I would say a couple things. I mean, probably the most important thing is, for university, like going to school, it's not about job training. So, one shouldn't think, hey, I need to do this so I can, get my first job. Going to school, I think, is really about learning how to solve problems, learning how to think. And then, your work life is continuous learning going forward. So one of the best pieces of advice I was given when I was a young engineer, frankly, was, one of my sort of managers at the time said, hey, Lisa, you should run towards problems. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. I don't really know what that means. But, the advice was, look, you went to school to solve problems. And so, once you get into the real world and you're at a job, you should run towards solving the hardest problems that you can find. Because when you do that, you learn a tremendous amount, right? That's how you really accelerate your learning. And frankly, that's how you distinguish yourself too, because you're going to work really hard anyways. You might as well work on a problem that's really important and that your company cares about or, the world cares about. And, if you do a good job, then, you'll get the next hard problem to solve.
I love that advice. And it evokes something I know Sam Altman always had told his Y Combinator companies, which is only play games when the prize is worth winning. Go after really big, worthy problems.
That sounds very similar.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lisa, for everything that you're doing to lead the industry and to lead the AI revolution. It's incredible to partner with you, and I can't wait to see what's next from you and AMD.
Thank you so much, Clara, and thank you for all that you're doing for the industry as well. It's wonderful to see Salesforce and how you're leading the industry.
Thank you. What an incredible conversation we just had. Three takeaways from me. First is that it's not just about optimizing the chip. It's about engineering and optimizing the whole system, which includes clusters of chips, software, and more. Number two is that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to innovation and to transforming an organization to continuously learn and adapt. It's really about having that top-down mandate from the CEO and from the board, and then empowering each functional leader all the way down to the individual contributor to come up with ideas and to continuously learn and experiment. Third and finally, there is the right compute for the right workload, whether that workload runs locally on a device, like these new AI PCs, on an embedded device, like in manufacturing, or in the cloud, and whether that runs on a CPU or a GPU, and orchestrating across all of these possibilities. And that is very much AMD strategy. That's all for this week on the Ask More of AI podcast. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and follow me on LinkedIn and X. To learn more about Salesforce and AI, join our Ask More of AI newsletter on LinkedIn. Thank you and see you next time.